I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Missouri voters will have a chance to bring a higher level of accountability to their state government. Today, we'll look at the Clean Missouri Initiative campaign. If passed, it would change the process of redistricting, place limitations on lobbyists and campaign fundraising, and open legislative records to the public. Then, Kansas City toymaker Donna Moore, her soft toy creations of the 80s and 90s were everywhere, from kids' bedrooms to movie sets. We'll ask Moore what the inspiration was for her playful designs. After that, songwriter Mike Stoller, he co-wrote Kansas City and Ain't Nothing Like a Hound Dog, whose name is being added to the American Jazz Museum Walk of Fame. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. This year, Missouri voters will likely get a chance to vote on a sweeping package of ethics reforms aimed at cleaning up Missouri state government. The Clean Missouri Initiative would eliminate almost all lobbyist gifts. It would require lawmakers to wait 2 years before becoming lobbyists. It would make the records of lawmakers transparent and not subject to secrecy. And it would do other things as well. And just a note, I'm a member of the STARS editorial board, and we've endorsed many of these ideas. Here to talk about it with us is Sean Nicholson. He's the campaign director for Clean Missouri. He's also the senior content strategist and research director at GPS Impact. That's the public affairs and multimedia advertising agency. He lives in Kansas City. Sean, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Where did this idea come from?
So we've all been watching what's happening in Jefferson City for years, and on the STARS editorial page and coffee shops around the state, there's conversations of this is pretty messed up. Why doesn't it ever get better? Why are there $1 million in gifts given every year? Why are records kept secret? Why do politicians get to become lobbyists the day after they resign or shortly after they resign? And there's a lot of good ideas that have been proposed. It's been a bipartisan movement in the legislature and outside of the legislature, but the leaders, the small group of folks who control the agenda in Jefferson City, keep blocking any sort of sensible reform. And so we said, enough is enough. It's time for citizens to take matters into their own hands. And we've been collecting signatures for more than a year now. We turned those in a couple weeks ago. And we're very excited to be running a campaign and looking forward to victory in November.
Well, given all that, you know, why did it take so long to get to this point? Why didn't this initiative happen 5 years ago or 10 years ago?
The short answer is that ballot initiatives are hard, and by design.
And expensive.
We turned in 346,000 signatures, and that takes
346,000?
Yeah, from every county in the state. So 346,000 signatures collected one by one, and that's time-consuming, and that's expensive. And we also have been fortunate to build a big coalition to make that happen, and a lot of the things that you've been talking about that we've been reading about in Jefferson City, there is an appetite and an atmosphere. It is time for a change in what's happening in Jefferson City.
So your point, Sean, is it's a certain coming together of a lot of things here. You need the signatures, you need the money, you need a favorable election year perhaps to get this thing passed. It's a lot of things you got to sort of focus on here.
I think that's right. And I've been amazed and I'm extremely excited about what has come together. I mean, it's not every day that you've got conservative senators like Rob Schaff from St. Joseph working together with progressives from St. Louis or Kansas City. But that huge coalition is how we've been able to collect so many signatures and why we feel so great about our prospects in November.
You know, I know you've touched on this, but if this idea is so good, why hasn't the General Assembly passed it?
That is a great question. And the simple answer is that the folks who control Jefferson City right now like things the way they are. They like a world where there's no limits of any kind on the lobbyist gifts that can be given. They like a world where 90% of legislative elections are non-competitive, and that means that the big donors who run the show can focus all of their dollars on just a few races. And that leaves voters back home out in the cold. We all know when lobbyists are giving so much money, when big donors are writing big checks, that they're getting influence. the only people who pretend to be offended by such a suggestion are the folks taking those meals and the folks who enjoy the status quo.
So the ultimate objective of what you're trying to do here is to clean up government. And what impact is this going to have? What's the hope?
So I think the immediate short-term impact is the lobbyist gift culture in Jefferson City ends. The practice by which legislators are thinking about their next job and, hey, who could I go lobby for right after I leave office, that ends because there's going to be a revolving door period. And then I think long-term, as the redistricting provisions come into play with after the next census and the next maps are drawn in 2021, we're going to see a world where there's a lot more competition and where legislators are going to be fearful of voters back home. And that's the whole idea, is that we need state legislators, we need politicians up and down the ballot to be worried about what voters think, not what a few gajillionaire donors might think.
So lessening the influence of big donors, lessening the influence of lobbyists, Sean, am I seeing that correctly?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I think, yeah, we need to lessen their influence and increase the influence of voters and people who can organize back home.
Let's walk through this thing just a little bit here. Then we'll get to some of the mechanics of this. One big proposal here contained in your package of initiatives called Clean Missouri. This is a big one. It would impose strong limitations on lobbyist gifts. You've already mentioned that here. What would it do exactly?
So it would set a hard cap of $5 for any occurrence, any sort of lobbyist gifts. So a cup of coffee that you get at the Lions Club, that's fine. A hamburger, a steak dinner, a trip to Florida, a trip to Greece, those are all off the table, no longer allowed.
And that stuff's happening today? Are we seeing tickets for sporting events, concert tickets? Are those activities still going on?
It is amazing and obscene and a bipartisan reality right now. It is the amount of free stuff that is just flows into the Capitol is just a sight to behold.
And as you know, lobbyists say, though, Sean, that stuff doesn't influence anything. I mean, a dinner's not going to buy somebody's vote. Concert tickets, you know, to the big show in St. Louis or Kansas City isn't going to do it. Tickets to the Cardinals isn't going to do it. What do you say to that?
I say lobbyists are hired to influence public policy. They're there to pass bills or to stop bills. And if it didn't have an impact, they wouldn't spend $1 million every year on freebies.
Is that what gets spent every year these days? $1 million?
So last year was more than $1 million. In the last 10 or 11 years, it's averaged just under $900,000 per year. That's every year, year over year.
The other argument here, though, is lawmakers don't make that much money. Why not give them a few perks?
Lawmakers get a per diem. That's the other part of this argument that the lawmakers that enjoy so much free stuff always say, of like, we don't make enough money. It's hard to balance work life, and that I don't dispute that to be true. I mean, but they do receive per diems that taxpayers pay for to cover their lodging and to cover their meals. And just like everyone else back home that's struggling to make ends meet, if they're having a hard time, they can take a ham sandwich just like the folks who voted and send them to Jefferson City.
One other part of this initiative, it would require that legislative records be open to the public. You know, a lot of people, Sean, might assume these records are already open to the public.
That is a reasonable assumption because the state legislature has imposed open records laws that apply to everyone else in government. They apply to the city council here in Kansas City, to county government, to the governor. But they have exempted themselves when it's just inconvenient for them from following basic sunshine laws. And so what that means is there are things that are kept off the books that public can't see about how policy is crafted, but it also means we've had real examples of reporters not being allowed to even have a camera in a committee hearing, a public committee hearing where our business is being conducted, and they're kicking TV cameras out because what they're about to do would be inconvenient for their careers.
Another component here, require lawmakers, again, you've referred to this, to wait 2 years before they can become lobbyists. Some folks have said that may be the most significant aspect of this entire package. Why is it significant?
When there's no speed bump of how quickly a politician can cash in as a lobbyist, you have situations where you're not sure who they're actually worrying about when they cast their vote. So there's speculation and talk in a final session of, oh, what am I going to do next? You know, my term limits are up. Folks are saying, hey, I don't know. And then now you've got lobbyists, you've got other folks dangling jobs, perhaps. And so that just creates a conflict of interest, like a real conflict sometimes, and certainly an appearance of a conflict more often than it should.
We're talking about the Clean Missouri initiative that we expect to go before voters either in August or November. One final component here, it would lower campaign donation limits. Sean, I thought voters had already done that in a big election a couple years ago.
Yeah, so Amendment 2 in 2016 was well-intentioned, and there's a reason voters voted for it. It was well-intentioned, but it's got a lot of holes in it, and it's been whittled away in the courts. And so we're lowering the contribution limits a little bit and also closing one great big loophole in which a billionaire donor, a millionaire donor can set up 100 different PACs and then have all of those PACs max out to a candidate. So what that means is, right now, there's a limit that says no check can be larger than $2,600. But there's no limit that says me as a big donor, I could set up three or four different committees and then have all of those committees give that maximum $2,600 amount. So it renders the whole point meaningless. And so one of the provisions we've got is to shut down that loophole for candidates for state house and state senate.
What does this thing do when it comes to dark money? You hear this sinister phrase all the time kicked around in the media, this notion that donors can give anonymously to nonprofits, which in turn then give to political causes. What happens with that?
So the Clean Missouri Initiative is the first of many things that need to happen to get our democracy on track. But one of the limits of the initiative petition process is that you can only focus on a single subject. And so our measure focuses just on the General Assembly. So our rules would just apply to candidates and current members of the House and Senate. I think there's a lot of really good ideas and things that need to happen. I'm optimistic we'll see those in the 2020 cycle, but that's going to have to be a fight that we pick a different day.
Now, you're waiting to see if you've got enough signatures to qualify for the ballot. You said you collected how many again?
So we've turned in 346,000 signatures.
How many do you need?
So we have to have valid, certified, around 175,000, 180,000 in 6 out of 8 congressional districts.
So you've done twice as many.
We have. And the reason you turn in more is some of those are from congressional districts that we don't need to qualify. And then also people move or they might sign in the wrong county. There's a lot of arcane rules that are set up to create hurdles for voters to have their voices heard. But we feel really good about our program and our campaign. And we checked every signature one by one. So doing that allowed us to have a lot of confidence before we did the turn in and allows us to keep plowing forward to November.
Now, you turn these into Secretary of State Ashcroft. When will he rule in terms of whether you have enough signatures or not?
We think that we'll hear back from Secretary Ashcroft in late July or early August. His deadline is August 14th. We are one of several campaigns that have submitted signatures, so voters will likely be voting not only for this legislative reform package, but to raise the minimum wage. There'll be several medical marijuana, up to 3 measures on the ballot. So it's an exciting moment in democracy and direct democracy from Missourians.
And this will be on the ballot in August or November?
It'll be on the November ballot. So
okay.
We may not even know for sure. We might get that formal certification until right after the August 7th primary, but everything is pointing to yes, and all of our campaign plans are for November.
Who's funding the Clean Missouri Initiative?
So we have received donations from across the political spectrum. We've collected, I think the last number I saw was more than 25,000 individual contributions right now. Hmm. We've been very fortunate to earn support from progressive leaders, from conservatives. It's an expensive campaign, and we're out there talking to anyone who will listen.
How confident are you, just a final question, that this thing is ultimately going to pass?
I'm really confident in where we're at now and in the plan that we have to win. We fully expect that the lobbyists, the big donors that enjoy the status quo are going to spend some money to fight back. But with the coalition that we've built, with the army of 346,000 people that signed this petition, that we've got all the support that we need to win way more than 50% of the vote in November.
I was going to say recent Missouri history suggests that voters will go for anything that smacks of cleaner government. Those initiatives tend to pass 60, 70% of the vote.
Yeah, there are a lot of partisan divides in Missouri and in the country, but this is a spot where everyone who's not in Jefferson City knows that things aren't on the level. And whether you're a Republican in Palmyra, where I grew up, or a Democrat in South Kansas City, where I live now, We don't have competitive elections. We know that the agenda and who's driving the agenda in Jefferson City isn't really worried about us.
That's Sean Nicholson, again, campaign director for Clean Missouri. You can find out more information. Just go to Clean Missouri's campaign website. Sean, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Steve. Really appreciate it.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with a famous toy maker right here from Kansas City and also a songwriter that you're going to want to hear and learn more about. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, Eric Greitens' historic announcement that he will be stepping down as Missouri's governor. We talk with reporters and lawmakers about what it means for the state and what comes next. You can hear that conversation and many others at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we'll talk to the incumbent running in what's likely to be one of the closest U.S. Senate races in the midterm elections. Join us for conversations with U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill. That's tomorrow on KCUR. Up to date. Well, if you were a kid in the 1980s or 90s or had young children then, you might not know her name, but you probably remember the soft stuff toys she created. They started right here in Kansas City, but were sold around the world. My next guest is the woman who crafted those cuddly, colorful creations, local artist Donna Moore. She's finishing up a year-long exhibit at the Toy and Miniature Museum over on the UMKC campus this weekend. Donna, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So I know you made dinosaurs because one of my producers had one, but you also crafted Mickey Mouse, anthropomorphic vegetables, musical pop stars. Seems like you pretty much made it all.
Well, I had a group of people that worked with me, and we kind of made it all, but I started kind of the whole thing.
Were all the ideas yours?
Mostly, yes.
Yeah. What do you consider to be your first creation?
The first creation that I really made was when I worked at Hallmark, was a dog. And it was made for Springbok Toys. And then you cut all the pieces out, and then you put it together.
Oh, really?
And that's how I got my start.
Why did you have that idea?
Well, Ruth Moorhead at Hallmark wanted, we were going to do Springbok toys, and we were going to do things that you put together and sew up yourselves. Mm-hmm. But they were going to do it with a needle and thread, not with a sewing machine. So you cut out the pieces, you put them together, and she saw something that I did, and she asked me to join the art department in Hallmark.
I was going to say, you got your start at Hallmark. Now, I read that Hallmark had a policy of hiring only right-handed people who were at least 5 feet tall, and you were neither of those things. So,
right.
Is that story true?
Yes, it is true.
Why? What was?
Well, I was in Flitter Flock, where you flocked and flittered cards, and then I was in hand packaging, and you had to be a certain height to reach over the belt to pick up the cards and put them in the gusset, and everything was set up for right-handed people, and so I wanted into Hallmark so bad that I had to adjust some things to get in there.
I was going to say, you eventually made it to the design department, but your bosses weren't too crazy, at least at first, about a line of stuffed toys. So how did you manage to convince them?
Well, Hallmark is a card company in the beginning, and Mr. Hall wanted it to remain a card company only. But then he adjusted to the fact that we might have other products to go with those cards to make things bigger and better as the company grew. So he decided to go ahead and let some of the divisions do toys.
And that was a big moment for you.
It was a big moment for me because I was better at designing with the sewing machine than I was with painting the greeting cards or stitching the greeting cards.
How quickly did the powers that be at Hallmark then sort of embrace what you wanted to do?
Well, the first thing that they did, I forgot his name because I'm old.
we all are, Donna.
We did a Petey pumpkin, which is a pumpkin. And he said, well, I just don't think it'll sell. And he wanted to order a small order. And they ordered something like 50 to 60,000. And the first week, not even the first week, they were all gone.
Huh.
And so they immediately ordered another round and got them shipped over very quickly, and they filled his office full of Petey pumpkins because he didn't believe in three-dimensional product.
And but, so he was proven wrong.
So he was proven wrong, and it changed his outlook on things as well.
Tell us how you made the jump from crafting stuffed carrots, for example, to making a plush Fab Four.
I had a one-man show at Hallmark Cards, and all of my work that I had done in all these years, they were showing it in a conference room. You know, every once in a while, they would, you know, highlight one artist and show all of their work. Well, it was my turn. And so a lady that worked for Determined Productions out of San Francisco saw my work, and she called me and asked me if I would design Beatles dolls. And I was like, oh, well, I don't know. I said, I really don't know if I can do that or not. I said, I work for Hallmark, and I don't want to miss out on getting my Rolex watch. You know. And she said, well, why don't you ask your boss if you can do that? And so I did. I just went in and asked my boss if I could design some dolls for Determined Productions. And he said, well, since we don't do dolls, you're free to do them. So I designed the dolls for Determined Productions.
Sort of on your own time.
Yes, on my own time, completely.
Did it ever cross your mind not to go for that gold Rolex wristwatch and sort of go off and do it on your own?
No.
No.
I was kind of a shy person then. I hadn't traveled much or been anywhere, you know, and I loved Hallmark. That's all I ever wanted to do was be at Hallmark Cards.
It was a great place to work.
It was, but then I made a big transition.
Which was?
Well, she called me after I designed the dolls and all the different things that happened in between, like she took them to see John Lennon's wife, and her son immediately tore the head off of one. And so
I was just going to ask about that. What did that say? There's a whole psychological deal there, probably.
Yeah, well, he was little. You know, he was,
so still, I had to say that.
And
though,
so
Donna,
she had to call me and say, you've got to make another one. So I had to make one overnight. And then she had them all in her suite at the hotel, and somebody took all the clothes off of them and took them. So I had to make a whole new thing of clothes. So it was a whole big deal. And since I did everything so quickly, and that was due to my boss, Don Dabowski, when I worked at Hallmark, because he was such a perfectionist that I kind of learned how to do some of those things. But, you know, then she called me and said, how would you like to come and work for me? And I said, I don't think so. I said, I'm just about 2 years away from getting my Rolex watch at Hallmark. And she says, well, I'll get you two. But she never did.
Oh. So you did make the jump.
I did make the jump. I was scared to death because I was such a people person, and I liked to see people and be around people, and being on my own in my own house was really creepy.
You know, you started traveling internationally for the toy business, you know, to France and Japan and Korea, and were often going to meetings in these all-male executive board rooms. What was that like?
That was really awful. I was in Japan, and Nobi Kimura was in charge of our Japanese office, and my boss, Connie, had gotten really sick, and she said, you're going to have to take over the meeting in Japan, and I'm going back to the States, and then after I get this taken care of, I'll come back and get you. Well, here I am alone in Japan, and I had to go to this meeting, and I went in, and Nobi introduced me, and everybody sat there and looked at him, and I began to speak about the World Wildlife Fund and the World Wildlife toys that we make, and how we make them, and how many we could have in their stock rooms, and get them all in there. And as I began to speak, they just kept looking at him, and I looked straight at Nobi, and I put my hand over the microphone and walked over to him, and I told him, I said, you tell each and every one of these men that they need to look at me. Huh. Because I'm a woman, but I'm a woman in business. So he did, and they all turned, and I said, and I will tell the boss if you don't tell them.
No kidding. And they did.
They did. They all turned and looked at me.
And they weren't looking at you because of...
They weren't looking at me because I wasn't the woman. I was a woman, and I wasn't in charge. Nobi was in charge. And their understanding in Japan at that time, because, you know, this was a long time ago, was that women aren't in business like they are now. There's more women in business.
I read that at one point you actually brought your sewing machine into the room to demonstrate the toy making.
Yes, I did.
In Japan, or where was that?
That was in Korea. I usually carried my sewing machine with me, which was a funny situation. And, you know, Americans don't like to be touched. And I was on the elevator going up to this style room to explain to these people how to make these dolls, you know, with the heads and the noses and everything.
Yeah.
And so I took my machine up there and I had to have an adapter. But as I was going up, we're all packed in this elevator, you know, and I'm very short, you know, and some of them are very tall. And I couldn't, I didn't understand how it was like that. And this man was looking straight at me, and he sneezed all over my glasses, over my face. And I was, I got off the elevator, they all just kind of, they took my glasses, they, you know, sat me down. It was just the funniest. It was really funny.
Well, I'm glad you're laughing about it. Yeah, okay.
That's funny.
We heard that a certain renowned movie horror villain had a surprise encounter with one of your toys. I'm thinking of Freddy Krueger.
Yes. One of my dinosaurs, it was the T-Rex, was on that program. And it was like, oh, my goodness, there's one of the dinosaurs.
You made it.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. It was also in Jurassic Park, the first Jurassic Park. All the dinosaurs were in the toy shop. It was really kind of, you know.
I'm visiting with Kansas City toy maker Donna Moore here. You know, I was going to say, if you haven't been to the exhibit yet or want to revisit it, you have just a few more days. Its final day at the National Toy and Miniature Museums is this Sunday to see Donna's work. The museum is open from 10 to 4. More information can be found at toyandminiaturemuseum.org. You know, what's your process like when you sit down to make these toys, Donna? Because I read something that your daughter wrote, and she said watching you make toys was absolutely mesmerizing.
I don't know. I guess my process is that I sit down and I just start cutting patterns. You know, I see things three-dimensionally, and sometimes I'll think about things overnight and maybe even dream about something. And then when I go into work, I actually know how to pull the pattern together. And then after you've done it as long as I have, I can pull just about any pattern together.
I gather you're pretty fast.
I am. Really fast.
Is that what made it so mesmerizing?
I think so. I'm pretty fast, and if I make a mistake, I tear the whole thing apart and start all over again. And some of my colleagues were like, I don't think I would do that, Donna. And I said, it has to be right. If it's not right, it's not sellable, you know.
So. Huh. Your daughter was the one who convinced you to ultimately do this exhibit at the National Toy and Miniature Museums. You were going to throw out all the toys that were sitting in your basement at one point?
Mm-hmm. I've got about maybe 3,000 toys in the basement still.
So how glad are you that you decided to do the exhibit?
Well, I don't like to take credit for everything that I do. I mean, you know, when you're the boss and you delegate, or you say, here, try this, or you can do that. And then I make most of the toys as well. But I had a few colleagues that I worked with. And then when my boss passed away, I started working with Susie Kozad, who is now working back at Hallmark. But Susie and I had a business called Market Works Design for, maybe 11 years or maybe 10 years, and we really worked hard. Susie was the one that helped me and do the dinosaurs and get those out on the market very fast. We had only 2 months to get those out.
Why just 2 months?
Because the movie was hitting the screen.
Ah, Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what's it been like for you having this exhibit with your name finally attached to it, because none of your creations actually bear your name?
Well, no one likes the light shined right on them all the time, but it makes me proud to know that I have done some things that, you know, when I'm not here anymore, maybe people will notice that that was something that Donna Moore did, you know, which is kind of a highlight in my career, really. It is the highlight of my career.
Watching kids play with those toys probably is one, too.
And I still make toys. I still make things for people. You know, actually, I've got three things that I just made, and I'm taking one down to First Friday this weekend that I made.
No kidding. So, where's it going to be?
What, First Friday?
Yeah, where? Yeah.
It's antiques down on First Friday. Sure. There's a lady down there that I made something for. So.
Okay, that's Donna Moore. Again, you can see her work and her sort of legacy here at the National Toy and Miniature Museums. The exhibit's on for a few more days. More information, toyandminiaturemuseum.org. So nice to meet you.
You too.
Great legacy.
Thank you.
Okay. Speaking of guys with a great legacy, we're going to be joined by one right now. Mike Stoller is back on the map. The man who co-wrote Kansas City is the same man who co-wrote Stand By Me, a song London's Kingdom Choir just sang at the royal wedding. That was described as one of the ceremony's highlights. And Mike Stoller is about to be back on the map for a different reason. On Saturday evening, he will be inducted into the American Jazz Museum Walk of Fame. That's in the 18th and Vine District, along with his longtime partner, that's Jerry Lieber. It's all part of a big weekend in the Jazz District that will feature a big Walk of Fame concert featuring David Sanborn, Marilyn May, and Ruben Studdard. Mike Stoller is already a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he joins me right now. Mike, what a pleasure. Welcome.
My pleasure, Steve.
Your song, Kansas City, is, of course, the unofficial anthem of this town. Where did the idea for that song come from, Mike?
Well, back in 1952, a fellow who owned a rhythm and blues record company called Federal Records said, why don't you write a song about Kansas City? Well, Kansas City to us, to Jerry and me, was a kind of magical place where great jazz happened. Count Basie and even though he wasn't a native, and Jay McShann and Charlie Parker, of course. And so it was a kind of wonderful place that we heard of but had not been.
I was going to say, you hadn't been here when you wrote that song?
The first time we got to Kansas City was, I think, 1968.
A lot of years after you wrote it, right?
Exactly, yes. And we wrote it for a singer named Little Willie Littlefield, who is a wonderful blues pianist and singer. And I remember we worked with a fellow named Maxwell Davis at his home, where we taught the song to Little Willie, and Maxwell did the arrangement and played tenor sax on that record.
Well, we've got the version here with Wilbert Harris, and we're going to play just a little bit of it, okay, Mike?
Sure.
Got some crazy little women there, and I'm gonna get me one.
That line, Mike, they've got some crazy little women there, and I'm gonna get me one. How did you figure that out about Kansas City if you hadn't been here?
Well, I tell you the truth. Jerry and I were teenagers, and we had incredible fantasies. And in the original record, it said, they got a crazy way of loving there, and I'm going to get me some.
Huh. When did it get changed?
I think that line was changed when Wilbur Harrison recorded it.
Ah, I gotcha.
Which was 7 years after the first record. And unfortunately, in the first record, the guy who owned the record company after it was recorded, and it's basically the same song, a couple of word changes that you've just pointed out, he decided to change the title of the song and called it KC Lovin'.
That's right, that's right.
Which didn't mean anything to us. In fact, we were very disappointed because the song is, I'm going to Kansas City, here I come. And So 7 years later, fortunately for us, Wilbert Harrison remembered the song and recorded it. And I was told about it by King Curtis, mm-hmm. the wonderful sax player who played on so many of our Coasters records. He had been on the session. He said, "Man, you guys got a hit coming, because that's really..." I was there, man.
How did you like the Beatles version of it, Mike?
I love the Beatles in general, but when Jerry and I were writing the song, Jerry was saying, I want it to just sound like a traditional blues, no specific melody. And I said, well, I want to write it so that if a band plays it, I would recognize it even without the lyrics. So we got in a little fight about that, and finally I said, well, who's writing the music? He said, okay, you are. And although the Beatles version, I think, was taken from Little Richard's record, which they heard.
Right. Let's listen to a little bit of the Beatles playing this song, Mike. Hang on a sec.
Gonna get my baby one time. Yeah, yeah. It's just a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Wow!
Mike, I want to fast forward to the events of this month and the royal wedding where your song Stand By Me was performed. Did you know the Kingdom Choir was going to perform it at the wedding?
The only thing that I knew was I was told that it was going to be among a number of songs that might be performed at the wedding, and I figured, well, that's great. But when I heard it on my phone, because my son forwarded it to me on, so that's the first time I heard it was on my phone, I was knocked out because I was so moved by it. Mm. First of all, the choir was so beautiful, and the performance of the young man or the male lead, and then joined by this wonderful woman on the chorus. It had all the feeling of the song, and yet it was solemn. And it seemed so appropriate for that occasion. And
let's listen to the Kingdom Choir's performance of what Mike's talking about. This is Mike's song, Stand By Me, is performed by the Kingdom Choir at the royal wedding.
When the night has come and the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we see.
Did you intend for that song, Mike, to become the wedding anthem that it's become for so many couples?
No, not really. But I'm happy about it, very happy about it. And I think what made Jerry Lieber and Benny King and me all very proud was its association with the civil rights movement.
You know, you've said, Mike, that Kansas City and Stand By Me will be songs that endure even decades from now, and I'm wondering why.
Well, you know what? I can't tell you why. When Jerry and I put together a show called Smokey Joe's Cafe, which ran on Broadway for 5 years, and that was in the 90s. We were astonished that songs that we'd written in the 50s and 60s were still remembered.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, there's a new production of Smokey Joe's Cafe that we just opened in Maine in a theater there.
Hmm.
And it's going to open in New York again in July.
Mike, let's listen a little bit to Ben E. King's version of Stand By Me, then I'll come back and say goodbye to you here.
Okay.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.
You know, Mike, that still sounds really good even today. What a great track.
Thank you so much. That was Ben's first solo recording. You know, he had been with the Drifters on some wonderful songs.
And it was your idea to do the bass opening, right?
Yeah, that's my bass line. And, Stan Applebaum, who orchestrated the strings, then brought it into the strings also.
Well, Mike Stoller is the newest inductee of the Walk of Fame at the American Jazz Museum. The American Jazz Walk of Fame induction and concert, 7 o'clock Saturday evening at the Gem Theater in the Jazz District. The induction ceremony will be at 6:30. Tickets, AmericanJazzMuseum.org. Mike Stoller, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, Senator Claire McCaskill's take on the Greitens fallout, and we'll talk with her about her campaign for re-election in November. We'll bring you an interview with her likely opponent, Josh Hawley, next week. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.